Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The victim was Gary Triano, a Tucson real estate developer with influential friends and enemies. After finishing a round of golf at a country club, he went to the parking lot and found a gift in his car, a crudely made pipe bomb that blew him to pieces. The bomb maker was Ron Young, a Colorado bad guy, wanted on weapons and fraud charges. The prosecution claimed that the woman he was dating at the time promised to pay him $400,000 to murder her ex-husband. Her name was Pamela Phillips, an Aspen socialite, divorcee, and mother of Triano's two children. She received $2 million upon his death, but evaded suspicion for more than a decade. Finally, halfway across the globe in Austria, authorities caught up with the blonde bombshell, igniting one of the most explosive cases in Arizona history. The book that we're featuring this evening is A Socialite Scorned, The Murder of a Tucson High Roller, with my special guest journalist and author, Kelly Drobin. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Kelly Drobin.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much. This is an incredible story. Let's get right to how you came to be in a position, why you felt compelled, or why you wanted to write this book, A Socialite Scorned.
Well, I was fortunate enough to have gone to law school in Tucson, and I had just become a lawyer at the time that Gary Triano blew up. And so Tucson is a very eclectic sort of, it's touted as a safe place to live, and it's much more reminiscent of the Wild West than of the socialite scene. It's an hour from the Mexican border. It's a good town to disappear in. And so when this bombing happened, it was sort of like a 9/11 moment. You know, everybody knew where they were when this happened because it was so shocking. And in so I was a lawyer at the time, and in 2005, you know, flash forward, Ron Young was named a person of interest on America's Most Wanted. It was a show that I watched pretty regularly for crime stories. And in a strange twist of fate, Jay Dobbins, who was the subject of my first book, Running with the Devil, was the very close friend of the investigator on the Gary Triano case, Detective Gamber. And Detective Gamber had asked him to help him orchestrate an America's Most Wanted episode that implored people to look out for Ron Young. And so when Ron Young was, eventually arrested and finishing his trial for the murder of Gary Triano, that's when I knew I had to write the story. I was positioned, you know, in the location for it. I was living in Phoenix at the time, but I was very close to Tucson. I knew the bombing. I mean, I had been, you know, around when that happened, and it was just, you know, it was right. It was an incredible story, and I thought, I've got to jump on this. So I had already written two books before I jumped on A Socialite Scorned, and thought this is a fascinating, this is like a writer's dream, you know, to go in there and mine the story and be able to write it from the point of view of basically two sociopaths.
Absolutely. Now let's talk about November 1st, 1996, as you do, the actual bombing murder itself, and you describe Gary Triano as a land developer, real estate mogul, as you mentioned, just had his 53rd birthday, 6'2", yes. 240 pounds. Tell us where he is. We talked about the golf resort. So set the stage as you do in this book. You talk about the borrowed Lincoln town car. Set the stage as you do in this book. Describe this.
So Gary Triano was he was a man who liked to portray himself as larger than life. He was a man who he didn't have, well, it's kind of unknown whether he had mafia connections, but he liked to portray himself as someone who had mafia connections. He had serious money. He was taking private jets to Vegas. He was insisting that he be called Mr. T when he was, you know, socializing with people. He hung out with the likes of Donald Trump. He would go to parties and events and buy rounds of cocktails for everyone, tipping waitresses ridiculous sums of money. He was like a character out of a Hollywood movie. And one of the most striking things about him, just to set the stage for this, is his home will give you a great indication of how he viewed himself. He had portraits of himself in his home as Indian chiefs and just everywhere you look, bronze reliefs of his head. He was just a larger-than-life person. So the murder, or when this happened, it was almost he led an explosive life, and so he had an explosive end. He played golf at the La Paloma Golf Resort, which is a pretty swanky place in Tucson, or it was at the time. And he was kind of a creature of habit, so he had a regular tee time, and he would go there and play golf. And so on the date that this happened, he was playing golf, and he was on his way to his birthday party, which was actually a surprise birthday party. But he got into his Lincoln Town Car. He habitually left the windows down, and there was a bag, like a sack, sitting on the passenger seat. And he thought it was, I mean, this is obviously presumed, but he thought it was a birthday gift. So he reached over to open it, and that's when his car exploded, and he exploded. And it was a sensational crime because the explosion, it was in broad daylight. There were a ton of witnesses. There were people dining at the fancy restaurant right above the golf resort. And the explosion was so large that there were pieces of the car that landed in the swimming pool. There were, the car itself is still, you can still view it. It was completely pulverized. And Gary Triano himself obviously was pulverized. So it was a crazy explosion, and it had the hallmarks of a mafia hit. And so it started this investigation into, you know, over thousands of suspects. It was one of these crazy whodunit cases of magnitude proportion. So it had a daunting list of potential suspects. The timeline for this murder, it spanned a decade, because whenever you have a bomb, it's going to bring in multiple jurisdictions, multiple agencies trying to track down, you know, the origins of the bomb. And because Gary lived this larger-than-life existence, he had so many enemies and so many people that had a motive to kill him that it became this crazy landscape for this one detective who, ironically enough, I mean, there are lots of ironies whenever you write a true story, but this case had a ton of ironies, because the detective, this was his first or second murder case ever in the department, and he was almost single-handedly tasked with the job of finding the suspect. So it was just really an incredible crime scene, and then an incredible investigation that followed. And I should mention, too, that the fact that it happens, I mean, not only do you have this explosion in Tucson, which I indicated a little bit earlier, is sort of known as this eclectic and safe place to live, but it's also the town for reputed mobsters who retire there, because it's considered this sort of open territory among mobsters. So they come and they used to come and conduct illegal activities without violating a hierarchy of organized crime. So you have the famous Arizona Republic reporter Don Bowles, who was targeted in 1976 by the mafia. And he was blown up outside, also killed in a car bomb outside of a hotel. So there were all kinds of you know, tentative links to the two kinds of crimes, and that sort of set this in motion as, you know, perhaps a mob hit.
You talk about the detective Gamber, James Gamber. He'd only been on the force 6 months, and he got this case, and he's the one of the central figures in this story. And you talk about, right away, the juxtaposition with these ATF agents coming into this resort, basically, with the black helmets and the bomb-sniffing dogs. So it was quite the scene, and you say a suspected terrorist strike or a mafia hit, so something that they were unaccustomed to. And you talk about, right away, the Gamber and his partner, Sergeant Keith St. John, and they are seeing, they're getting reports of vehicles leaving the scene, but like you say, that there's so many leads, so many conflicting reports. And then you talk about Pamela Phillips, and you tell a little bit about her background, this attractive real estate agent. So tell us a little bit about Pamela Phillips and what she's doing before she meets Gary Triano.
Okay. So Pamela Phillips is Gary Triano's ex-wife. They had been divorced a couple of years, actually, before this bombing happened. And the way that I like to describe Pamela Phillips is sort of beware the real person inside the costume. She was, and I describe her in the book, and I think it's fairly accurate given the evidence that was presented in the case, but I describe her as a sociopath. She is a figure who used and abused people to get what she wanted, and what she really wanted was money, no matter the cost. So case in point, she marries Gary for money, she divorces him over money, and she eventually kills him for money. She felt like she comes into the marriage, she has $2 million in assets, and so when she targets Gary, Gary at the time had about $2 million in assets. He was involved in the casino world, the Indian gaming casino business, and so she believed that she was getting into a marriage that was on equal par with her. You know, she brought money in, he had money, and they were going to build an empire together. And so what eventually happens and what she learns pretty early on in the marriage is that Gary is not what he seems or who he seems. In fact, he's embroiled in about 74 lawsuits. He is on the verge of bankruptcy. He owes everybody money. He owes his attorney money, $91,000 to an attorney. He owes $68,000 to his mother, $30,000 to a fitness club. He's $1.8 million in business debts and loans. So he's really not who he seems. And so Pamela discovers this, you know, as I said, early on in the marriage, and so she feels very entitled and very scorned, and that's really why the title of the book is pretty apropos. So when they get divorced, they have a number of fights over child support and alimony, and because Gary has filed for bankruptcy and he doesn't have the assets that she once believed that he had, she is incensed over this, and she takes him back to court multiple times. And but the key part of this investigation and why Detective Gamber ultimately zeroes in on her as a possible suspect is that during the marriage, Gary purchased a life insurance policy, and he insisted that, and a life insurance policy, coincidentally, is worth $2 million, and he insisted that she be the beneficiary, or the trustee, and his children were the beneficiaries, but she was the trustee over that until the children reached the age of 18. And so the premium for the life insurance policy was not paid by Pam. Pam, as she always did and very consistent with her character, would commission other people to do her bidding. And so she had entrusted her good friend, Joy Bancroft, with the task of paying her life insurance premiums. And so Joy Bancroft was a person who had over the years loaned Pam a lot of money, because one of Pam's sicknesses or illnesses is that she always believed she had no money. even though she had money and never worked a day in her life when she was married to Gary, she always believed she was just, you know, impossibly poor. So she commissioned Anne Bancroft to pay the life insurance premiums. And so around the time of the bombing, Pam discovered that Joy had neglected to pay the premium. I mean, it was the October premium. And so the life insurance policy was going to lapse. So here she had orchestrated this murder and expected to recoup what she believed she was entitled to. She brought $2 million into the marriage. She believed she was entitled to the $2 million back, and she was going to get it no matter the cost. And so, you know, her payback was going to be the life insurance policy. So when she discovered that Joy Bancroft had not paid that premium, she almost went into a panic, almost drove herself insane, and was on the phone trying to get the premium paid, you know, trying to have a grace period. And so eventually she gets that premium paid, and eventually the life insurance policy pays out. But that becomes the trigger for Detective Gamber, you know, because usually the spouse is the number one suspect in a murder case. But this was an unusual case. They had been divorced. She lived in Aspen at the time. She had already established a different life in Aspen. So she wasn't even in Tucson. She had no proximity to Tucson. In fact, she and Gary had this parenting plan where Gary would have to fly out to Aspen to see the children. The children were sometimes flown from Aspen to Tucson. It was very complicated. So she was not an immediate suspect because she wasn't even in Tucson, and they couldn't fathom how she could possibly have, you know, orchestrated a bombing or constructed a bomb. So she was very far removed from the actual murder until Detective Gamber had exhausted a number of leads and kept coming back to that life insurance policy.
You talk about the complication in Gamber, inexperienced homicide detective, but also the amount of leads and also a lot of the efforts by her herself to be able to stifle the investigation. And to complicate this, she also talked about the restraining order she had against Gary, and she weaved a story about people looking for him, wanting him sleeping with a loaded gun. Tell us a little bit about the story she gave and what Gamber heard from her about her husband, ex-husband.
She was, Pam was very crafty. I kind of, she was almost crazy like a fox. You know, she knew how to keep Detective Gamber at bay, and so she was interviewed a number of times. And what she did, and a lot of this bore out to be true. She created a story that Gary was a wife abuser, that he had a volatile temper, that he was involved with, he had Mexican deals that had gone south, and they fraudulent transactions that created sort of death threats. And whether or not those actually panned out are, you know, I don't know that Detective Gamber was ever able to support that. But what she did was she convinced Detective Gamber that Gary had a number of enemies, that there were this Mexican deal where almost like a cartel was after him and had left him death threats. And so Gary started to carry a gun. And she created a story that, you know, Gary was sort of paranoid and thinking that everybody was following him and had a gun hidden under the pillow of his bed, and, you know, one night had actually held it to her, and so she was a victim of domestic violence. So that was the portrait that she portrayed to Detective Gamber. she also told Gamber that Gary had mafia connections and that maybe this was a mob hit and he should be investigating, you know, those connections or those links. And so over the course, I mean, this investigation lasted a decade, and Detective Gamber would go down various bunny trails, you know, to see whether any of them were going to pan out. And none of them actually did, but he got calls everything from potential mafia hits to Hell's Angel connections, you know, and he had to investigate every one of them because he just, you never know until you go down those bunny trails whether or not you can eliminate them as a witness. So she was very clever in doing that and in painting that picture that Gary was a volatile person, never paid back his debts, owed a ton of people money, and that part was true. He did owe a ton of people money. He did have failed business deals. He, was involved in casinos and things that certainly could have led to people having a beef against him. There was another key suspect, and whether or not Pam had planted this or this was Detective Gamber's own finding, but he became a potential suspect, a man by the name of Neil McNeese, who was an acquaintance of Gary's, and he agreed to purchase an item at a charity auction. Gary agreed to pay Neil 50%, and they tried to get him to go into business together, but eventually Gary asked Neil for a loan, and he used Pam's wedding ring as collateral, and the wedding ring was worth $235,000, and Gary wanted an $85,000 loan, and so Gary switched the ring, and he gave Neil a cubic zirconia ring, and so there was this whole backstory that Neil potentially had a motive to kill Gary because he was obsessed with the bait and switch that Gary had done. And so there were all kinds of stories like that Pam concocted to kind of throw Gamber off the path. And what was interesting about it was, while Detective Gamber is investigating all of these leads, you have the ATF and the other federal agencies investigating the bomb. So, one part is investigating the people, the other part is investigating the actual, manner of death. The bomb, which happened to be more sophisticated than most, it was unusually long, it was stuffed with red dot powder, it was the same kind of powder that was used to reload shotgun shells, it had 6-volt battery lantern, which was very popular in the 70s, and so they were trying to get a profile on the bomber. So that was what was going on the federal level. So you can imagine all the movable parts with all of the various characters involved. And so that was, I think, Gamber's challenge, was he was dealing with Pam, who was, a very skilled sociopath, knew how to use people, knew how to manipulate people, and knew how to twist things to serve her own advantage.
How did she respond to Gamber's polygraph request, and what did he deduce, or what did he say to her as a result?
Well, he had at least, I think, 3 interviews with Pam over the life insurance policy, and I detail that pretty well in the book because it's just so striking, her responses to him. She's very evasive with his questions. I can't recall now whether she agrees to take a polygraph or not, but Gamber basically says to her, it's kind of crime investigation 101. If somebody doesn't agree to take a polygraph, they're pretty much a suspect or they're pretty much guilty. So she's very evasive. And the whole time that she's being interviewed by Gamber, she's deflecting, and basically going back to, we've been divorced, Gary's got multiple enemies. And so they're almost startlingly revealing about her character and who, how she operates.
You talk about her niece, Melissa, is told by Gary's lawyer that he thought Pamela did this. And Melissa gave police a list of shady characters authorities should consider. You also talk about a couple friends that were to meet Gary the night before he was murdered, and also somebody that set up the golf date. So Detective Gamber had his hands filled with trying to investigate this case, as you mentioned.
Yes. Yeah, and that was actually complicating the whole thing was that there was this surprise party that was planned. And so, as you can imagine, the irony of that is the invitations had gone out, and on the invitation it says, "Let's roast Gary," which, of course, is very ironic since he's blown up. So Detective Gamber also had to figure out who attended that surprise party, whether there was anybody that was held back, you know, whether there were people that knew Gary's schedule. And strangely enough, even though Gary was a creature of habit, on this particular tea time, he had actually changed his schedule. So somebody would have had to have known, you know, who had changed the schedule. And so Detective Gamber had to look at, you know, the list of possible suspects or people that might have known that, might have played with him. You know, Gary had a golf partner that played with him. So there were a number of sort of what I call secondary characters that Gamber had to exhaust as possible leads. And I think when Melissa gave him the list of players, you kind of get a picture of Gary as, you know, he had so many enemies, so many potential people, and it sort of comes with the territory of somebody who is that connected, that involved in different business deals, and also somebody who was, you know, touting himself as fairly wealthy. So he was a target not only for who he was as a persona, but also for who he may have pissed off during his business dealings. So yeah, it was a completely exhaustive list, and it went from everyone from his CPA to his golf partner.
You also talk about the investigated Gary's former girlfriend, Robin Gardner, and that they had some evidence that at least she was a little bit of a person of interest. Tell us what they talked to her about and what she had said to them.
Robin Gardner was someone that Gary actually had a child with. And Robin was another key player because she also painted a picture of Gary being somewhat volatile. There was an incident where she threw a vase at Gary. They had gotten into an argument. She had thrown a vase at Gary. And there was an insinuation that Gary was trying to pay her off or buy her off to keep the pregnancy quiet. And so there was a belief that Robin may have gone, you know, a little nuts over that deal, you know, to keep that pregnancy quiet. So she became a person of interest. And Gamber and his partner had flown down to interview her as well to find out a little bit more about Gary and, you know, what that arrangement might have been and whether she had a motive. And she also had conversations with Pam. It was almost like the two had become, I don't want to say confidants, but, you know, they were sort of having a telephone communication about Gary and about how they had both sort of been scorned by him. So, you know, she became the woman scorned on the opposite side. So it became this really entangled web of, you know, Gary and his relationships with business people and Gary and his relationships with his ex-wife and his girlfriend and, you know, whomever else he may have been involved with. So it was really a complicated, tangled web of, you know, people that Detective Gamber had to sift through. It was almost like sifting through bomb debris, but, you know, metaphorically debris from Gary's personal life that had just exploded, and Gamber had to sift through all the, you know, all the pieces for that too.
You chronicle the incredible pressure that this Detective Gamber is under and puts himself under, it seems. But he also has the added pressure of hearing from Gary's daughter, Heather. So what kind of pressure does Heather exert on Gamber?
Well, I think Gamber probably experiences what a lot of homicide detectives might experience, which is just haunted by the fact that he cannot solve this case. And what happens is Heather is, I don't want to say hounds him, but Heather is on him for years. You know, why can't you find somebody? Why haven't we solved this crime? And, you know, he's just sort of shattered personally by this, because it's almost, it becomes his, it's the case of his career, certainly. And he puts aside everything. He puts aside his personal relationships, his other cases. And it becomes his life's quest to solve this case for Heather. And so he's actually very close to the family now, and he's close to Heather. But I think at the time he was really haunted by this. And it was his motivating factor. It was almost like he lived, slept, breathed, you know, finding the killer. And, you know, and so as he would develop one lead, Heather would be calling him and showing up and saying, why can't we find this person? And it, you know, to some degree, I think it really ate away at Detective Gamber, and it destroyed him. And it left him with this sort of empty feeling, you know, if I don't find this person, I will have spent a decade of my life, you know, trying to solve something. It was the whodunit of his career, you know, trying to find that out. But it was almost an impossible task for not only a new homicide detective, but any homicide detective. It would have been an impossible case. And so he was like a dog with a bone, you know. I've got to find out who did this.
Now tell us when and what are the circumstances in them finding a Voyager van.
So, Ron Young, and I guess in order to back up a bit, I have to explain a little bit about who Ron Young was.
Sure.
So, as I explained, Pam's modus operandi was to use and abuse people, and so she got by in life by really aligning herself with particular men that she could use and do her bidding. And so when she decided that she was going to get back at Gary, and she didn't quite know how she was going to do that yet, she was living in Aspen, and she was kind of hobnobbing around with the ski socialite people. And Ron Young was really a kind of a bum up in Aspen. And he was a con artist, and he called himself an outfitter, and he was almost Pam's mirror self. He was gawky, very socially awkward. But what he had in common with Pam was that he aligned himself with people that he could use and abuse. And so they had a very strange symbiotic relationship where, as long as he was useful to Pam, he could stay in her life. And as long as Pam found him useful, she would keep him around. So he became the hitman in this case, and she commissioned him to help her get rid of what he termed the 300-pound gorilla. So he determined that Pam needed his assistance to help with the Gary problem, and she hired him to do that. And so they concocted, over the course of a period of time, they conspired together to figure out how they were going to do this. Now, it's unclear whether Pam knew that Ron was going to use a bomb as the weapon, because they had gone and they had tried various things. I mean, I think she thought it was going to be a gun or a rifle or something, and they had taken a trip together to try to purchase that. So Ron kept what's really termed as a treasure trove of information. He kept every piece of document, every conversation, every fax, every card, everything that he ever had, any exchange with Pam, he kept. And it was so almost like he was a pack rat, except that it was probably a little bit more diabolical than that. He didn't want to be screwed over. So he kept the gun that they purchased. It was a sawed-off shotgun. He kept it in a case in a van He kept the postcards that Pam sent him. She actually sent him a Hallmark card that said, you know, I'm basically to the extent of, I'm looking forward to the vision of our future. I'm looking forward to being, you know, having this completed. I mean, it wasn't a confession, but it was tantamount to that, you know, that they had colluded together to do this. But he kept that. Every conversation they had, he recorded, and he kept all the recordings. And, you know, he had documents from Pam's divorce in this van, because at one point he had gone down to Tucson to kind of scout out the assets. This is what he told Pam, but he was looking to find out where Gary might have hidden money, you know, what his hidden assets were. So he was down there as a quasi-investigator, and he had checked into a hotel down in Tucson. He had stayed for 18 days. He used the name of a dead person to check into the hotel, and he was sort of stalking Gary for 18 days. But that documentation, the receipts, the rental car receipts, the divorce documentation, was all kept in this van. And so after Ron, there's so much involved in this, but Ron eventually steals from Pam, and he steals about $300,000 from her. And he believes in his mind that he's entitled to this because he has, quote-unquote, helped Pam with her business. And her business at the time was an astrology business. It was called Star Babies. And so he believed that he was being helpful to her by helping her with her finances. So he took the $300,000. Pam reports that, not realizing that Ron is the one who has stolen from her. So she reports it to Detective Crowley, who's with the Aspen Police Department. And as Detective Crowley starts investigating this, Pam, realizes that it's Ron who's done this. And so she backs off of the fraud investigation. So Crowley is now on the hunt for Ron. There's a fraud warrant out for him. Ron takes off from Aspen, and he goes back to Yorba Linda, California, which is where his parents live. And strangely, he parks this van with all of the paraphernalia from his relationship with Pam. He parks it on a street that's like a block from his parents in Yorba Linda, and he leaves it there. And then Ron goes underground. So as Detective Crowley is investigating this fraud investigation, he sees on the news that there's been a bombing in Tucson, and the name Ron Young pops up. Or I don't even know if it's Ron Young, but it's the bombing, and there's this investigation. And so he starts to link up with, he finds this van, and he sees information in the van that links back to that bombing. And so that's when he contacts Detective Gamber, and they start this whole investigation, and they zero in on Ron as a potential suspect. So it's a very complicated, convoluted thing, but Ron Young is the one that he leaves this trail. It's almost like a Hansel and Gretel trail, popcorn, that detectives are able to, you know, sort of follow. And as the pieces start to fit together, that's how they start to zero in on him as a possible suspect.
We're going to use this, Kelly, as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about ZipRecruiter. A friend of mine who listens to True Murder just messaged me a few weeks ago to tell me about his personal experience with ZipRecruiter. He'd started his company about 2 years ago, and they were doing very well. It's a small company with staff he assembled from years of working in the field, but he said he had recently tried to find and hire one new employee who was finally retiring from the industry, and he was having a hard time. So he said after hearing details about ZipRecruiter, he decided to check out what ZipRecruiter was claiming. He looked at how ZipRecruiter worked, and he appreciated their choice of resume formats and really liked their unique mobile apply process, where, as promised, he said he got a lot of applicants and very quickly found the new right employee he was looking for. Now, with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click, so you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates. Then ZipRecruiter posts its smart matching technology to work. actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting so you receive the best possible matches. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through their site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. We were talking about, Kelly, about the law closing in on Ron Young and Pamela. But meanwhile, you talk about in the book, very, very fascinating, this years of this investigation going on, but the relationship between Ron Young and Pamela Phillips and their correspondence. So as you do in the book, tell us about some of the conversations and the deteriorating relationship that they have over the years and why.
Sure. This was a fascinating kind of a bird's eye view into the minds of two sociopaths that were very similar in character, I believe, even though they probably didn't realize that. But so what happens is, you know, Pam hires Ron. And I should say that the strange part about this case is that while Ron records everything, has every conversation, every email, everything saved, the one conversation that he does not record is the conversation where the two of them actually conspire to murder Gary Triano. And that was the subject of the trial and just how strange that was, that that is not recorded. So that's all sort of supposition. But what happens is Pam hires Ron to murder Gary. And she tells him, you know, I've got this $2 million life insurance policy. I'm going to pay you $400,000 to do this, and we're going to be done. What she doesn't realize, and perhaps what Ron doesn't realize, is that you can't just write somebody a check for $400,000 and be done with it because it's going to be traceable. So they wind up in this crazy situation where Pam has to figure out how she's going to pay him. And so every week, they have this dialogue where Ron says, you know, I want you to send, did you send me my stuff? Did you send me my things? They never quite name it, but he's got codes for everything. And so he tries to educate her on how to communicate in code. So he's got these elaborate coded emails that he thinks are going to disguise his whereabouts. And Pam's emails are very telling. You know, things like Pam Phillips, Meadow, Aspen@yahoo.com, you know, and so it's almost like a telegraph, you know, here I am, come get me. So Ron is very frustrated with her inability to understand how to be undercover. So that's the first problem. The second problem is he'll email her and he'll say, you know, did you get me my stuff? I need 16 or I need 14. And so what that means in code language to Pam is she has to get him $1,600 or $1,400. And the way that she has to do this is so convoluted because you can't just, again, you can't just write a check. So she has to do this elaborate thing where she'll go to the grocery store, she'll get $300 cash back, and so that'll be part of the $1,600 she's going to send to Ron. So she's doing that. Then she's going to five different banks, taking very small increments at a time so nobody can trace her. Then she drives from Aspen to this little town called Basalt, which is about 20 miles away. She has to drive there in snow and ice conditions. She goes to a FedEx drop box. She has to use a dead person's name to send it. So, you know, she's confused at one point. She says to Ron, I don't understand. I'm a dead person. My sender and receiver are the same name. So she's very confused by the whole logistics of getting him money. And meanwhile, when she sends this money to him, she then has to tell him, you know, the stuff has been sent. I sent it on Saturday. So sometimes she misses the send date. And Ron gets angry and, you know, contacts her and says, you know, you missed my delivery, my Saturday delivery. So meanwhile, Ron is living as a mole. He's living underground. He doesn't have a driver's license, you know, can't get a job, can barely rent a place, but he's living in an apartment or a hotel room in Florida, and he has to take a taxi to a money order place to pick up his money. So he's living in this very sparse, almost invisible existence for a very long time. And so Pam, over the course of time, really starts to lose her mind. She starts to go crazy because she doesn't want to have this connection anymore to Ron. And she's living in this state of hypervigilance and fear because, you know, each communication she has with him is another opportunity for the law to come down on her. So she will try things, you know, where she won't communicate with him for a couple weeks, and then it makes Ron completely paranoid and crazy, and he starts communicating more. And so then they have these exchanges where they're perpetually locked in their own prison, which is the biggest irony of this story, is that she does this for money because she thinks money is going to free her. Ron does it for money because he thinks money is going to free him, and yet they wind up locked together forever in this almost horrific parody of a marriage where they cannot get rid of each other, they can't go a day without communicating with each other, and they have to communicate about the same subject over and over. And if one of them tries to leave, the other one holds it over them. So it's almost like this, not only a prison, but almost like a blackmail situation. And so at one point, Ron uses that leverage on her, and he says, you know, I have so much stuff on you that you're going to wind up in a woman's prison one day. I'm going to bury you. And so that's the one conversation or recording that nails them both, that links them and nails them. And so neither one of them has the freedom that they wanted. And it really is sort of it's an interesting expose in what happens to people that are so greedy, that live their life dictated and motivated by money.
It's incredible the exchange that they have at some point, because there's so many delays and because she's constantly complaining about having no money and having to deal with her kids. And again, the prospect of having no money is such a great fear. But then he has prostate cancer and is basically incredibly dependent on those payments being timely, because he has major surgeries and cancer treatment that he can't be late with payments.
Right.
Incredible exchange between these two people. And she, after he pleads with her basically, which wasn't his first approach, she doesn't send the money.
Right. Right, and that's another interesting aspect of this, because, you know, underlying this relationship is always this sense with Pam that if he would just go away, if he would just die, I'd be free, you know. And so she does have incredible power and control over his life at this point, because Ron has to get surgery in Mexico because he can't go to a hospital in the United States and be detected. So it's very complicated for him to actually get the procedure done and for him to have the cash that he needs to be able to get it done. So he is very dependent on her. And while he's spiraling, and again, you know, if you want to look at it metaphorically, he's literally being eaten up, eaten from the inside out, because the cancer is getting to him. So the stress of being connected to her, the stress of living like this mole, is getting to him. It's literally killing him. And now she has the power to literally let him die off. You know, so now she'll have two murders on her head. So that's almost her ticket out, is to be able to let go and just let him be released. And meanwhile, what she's experiencing is even weirder, where she feels like this need to have this sort of catharsis, you know, clear her energy space. She's very much into Vedic astrology at this point. She's spending thousands of dollars going abroad, going to Peru, going to India to try to get healing treatments so that she can heal her inner core. And at one point, in another ironic sort of, you know, life imitates art moment, she gets a little bit disfigured on her face. And so she goes overseas to try to get healed, to try to get this, you know, whatever her skin imperfection is off of her face, and she can't do it. And so she's living with almost the, you know, when she looks in the mirror, she sees herself becoming uglier and uglier. And so it's really an interesting, again, an interesting expose on what not only what greed can do to a person, but what it can do to live with a secret that the two of them share. They are bonded forever over the secret that they have conspired to murder another person. So, you know, I guess it's the ultimate story of crime doesn't pay, because ultimately you're going to either die from the stress, die from the fear, you know, or die from the prison sentence itself. So I think in a lot of ways, especially I think for Pam, when she finally does get arrested, it's almost a relief, because now she can stop living this lie, she can stop running, she's caught, and she can finally just sort of be this crazy person that she's become and be left alone in a cell. I mean, it's a very interesting portrait of what happens to the human condition when they're put in these extreme situations.
You also talk about the added pressure for both of them in that she invites Heather to her home to live with her, and he is cautioning her that she's going to read these articles, and these articles in certain newspapers were pointing to Ron and Pamela in not favorable light whatsoever, so that if she were to read these articles, there would be completely different attitude, they thought, both of them. And yet, that was the added pressure as well. Now, as you do, you talk about, we get back to America's Most Wanted and what the producers and the police net as a result. This was produced in February 1st, 2005, but it was aired November 19th, 2005. So tell us, as a result, what happened, and tell us about the arrest of Ron Young.
Well, in another ironic life imitates art moment, whenever you have people that are creatures of habit, this is ultimately what nails Ron. I mean, he lives this very invisible life, and yet one of the things that he insists on is his weekly chiropractor appointments. And so he had these standing appointments, and each time he went, he would take a taxi, he would take his briefcase, which contained his gun and, you know, his most precious possessions, and he would go in and he would have his chiropractor appointment. But what happened was he stopped paying his chiropractor. And so when America's Most Wanted aired, you know, it was a brilliant move on Detective Gamber's part, and it was also executed in a way that I think is sort of unprecedented for that show. And it really happened as a result of the connection he had with Jay Dobbins and all of the media attention that Jay Dobbins was getting for the Hells Angels case. And so they were able to get it aired on the show quickly. And because of the national attention that it got, the chiropractor's office and his chiropractor saw the episode, contacted America's Most Wanted and said, he's my client, and by the way, he hasn't paid my bill, and P.S., he has an appointment scheduled. And so they were able to come in and arrest him at his scheduled appointment based on that tip and that lead.
Now, how do they proceed once they have him in custody? What's his demeanor like, and how does he approach this? How do both parties approach this interview?
Well, Ron is, interestingly enough, Ron's interview with investigators, I think, is very similar to Pam's interview with Detective Gamber when she's being interviewed about, you know, whether or not she's going to take a polygraph, whether or not she had any involvement in this. They're both very evasive. Ron, however, has an added twist in that his big thing in life, because remember, he's lived this invisible existence for a while, and this is very counter to his personality, because he likes to take credit for things. He wants people to know that he's the one that orchestrated this, that he's the one that, you know, is the mastermind in things. And so he goes into this elaborate detail with the detectives about how, you know, he's a gun aficionado, he's like either sold, you know, things to high-powered people. He paints himself up as this almost larger-than-life character, and it's almost to the point of ridiculousness. And it gets him in trouble because prior to him being arrested for this case, he's arrested and in custody with a cellmate who becomes a key player in this case. And the cellmate, Andre Mim, is sort of known as the jailhouse lawyer. Ron starts to blab and brag to Andre Mim about how he orchestrated a bombing. He doesn't go into great detail about who it was, but he says, you know, I'm the one that did that. And he insinuates that he's the one that may have been involved in another bombing in Colorado. So he creates this larger-than-life profile for himself, which ultimately is his undoing because he has to be recognized. You know, he doesn't want to live in this mole existence anymore, and this is his opportunity to shine. So that's his undoing. It's his sort of braggadocio profile or persona with the detectives that is not only bizarre but also kind of nails his coffin.
You talk about that the detective O'Connor, along with his partner Coase, they said that they asked him if he had watched the show, America's Most Wanted, and he smiled slightly, he said. So they really understood going in beforehand how to play this guy and to play to his ego.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, he was a complete egomaniac. He needed to have credit. He needed to be the one that was in the spotlight and the limelight. And I suppose that's the reason that he kept this treasure trove of information. I mean, not only as a way to blackmail Pam, but also as a way to make sure that everybody knew he was the intelligent one. He was the mastermind behind all of this.
And so how do they get to the core of Pamela's involvement in this, in her husband's murder?
Well, they had to first, you know, they found Ron's computer, which again is strangely left behind and with all of the files that he has with Pam. So some of the files are, they'll say, before doomsday, you know, and so he keeps copious records where he's communicating with Pam. And so the detectives have to go through these thousands of audio recordings and the computer files in order to try to link these two together. They link them financially. They have a forensic financial person come in and sort of track the money. They link them through the recordings. They link them through one recording in particular, which is where they're talking, or Ron talks about, you know, you'll find yourself, or when you're sitting in a woman's prison, you know, they're going to find all of this stuff, or they'll find all of the secrets that have been buried. And so they start to piece it together, because the one thing that Ron was pretty clever about is, you know, he had this coded language with Pam. So they had a lot of circumstantial evidence, but they didn't have anything necessarily the smoking gun. And so, you know, so they pieced it together, and these were the few audio recordings that actually exposed it, because again, Ron needed to be recognized. He wasn't going to go down, you know, down with the flagship and not be known that she was also involved. So that's how they wind up piecing it together and sort of linking her back to that. It's a process of sifting through a lot of this information, because the thing that they were stumped about was, how did she do this? Because she wasn't a bomb maker, you know, she was more bombshell than bomb maker. How did she orchestrate this from Aspen? And what was her motive? I mean, the motive, I think, was pretty obvious. It was money. But, you know, there were all of these sort of movable parts as they were trying to piece it together and find her. And then, of course, by this time, she had already disappeared to Europe. She had at least one child in Europe at the time, and so they believed that she had gone to maybe visit with her child. But she winds up falling right back into the lifestyle that she had been so successful at in the United States. She finds a wealthy man in Austria and starts living in sort of a penthouse lifestyle, which again is very unusual, because you would think she'd want to go underground, but she didn't. And so things start to circulate in through the international channel, so Interpol picks up a bulletin on her. And ironically enough, she is caught in a very similar fashion to Ron, because her limousine driver turns her in. She doesn't pay her limousine driver. And so she's sort of wanted for petty theft over there. And so when that catches up to the Interpol bulletin, now they've got their suspect. And so they capture her in Vienna. They keep her in Vienna. And the complication for the case in the United States is they originally, Pima County wants the death penalty. So
right.
They won't extradite as long as there's the death penalty in place. So they had quite, you know, another couple of years where they couldn't bring her over. They had extradition proceedings, and then eventually they dropped the death penalty, and so she winds up coming over. But even more complicated than that, originally, Pima County Attorney's Office wasn't going to prosecute. It was almost an insurmountable odd, you know, to get her over here and to, you know, to build the case against Pam. And so the children begin, Gary's children and Robin's child come together in a civil lawsuit, and they win in a civil lawsuit. It's a wrongful death civil lawsuit. They win $10 million. So all of Pam's assets are frozen, and because they win on the civil case, that drives the criminal case. And it's almost this theory that, you know, Pima County is not going to, they have to prosecute now. There's no way that, you know, they can lose, so they can, a civil case can win, and then there's no criminal case, no companion criminal case. So that's what kind of fuels it. And then they bring her over after they drop the death penalty. So a very complicated case all the way around.
You talk about the trial. Tell us a little bit more about the very first attempt to question Pamela about this.
Well, you mean when she's over in the United States jail?
Yes.
She plays the insanity card. And whether or not she's actually crazy, I mean, I do believe there's evidence that she begins to lose her mind as
sure.
the case unravels. You know, she clearly, she's living in a home in Aspen, where she believes there are now bats in the walls, you know, flying through the home. So she's clearly got some delusions at this point. But whether or not she's
right.
incompetent to the point where she can't stand trial is a whole other, you know, theory. But so
sure.
she presents herself as she's mentally ill. She doesn't know what's going on. She's completely innocent. No idea why she's incarcerated. And so her defense team has to take her through Rule 11 competency proceedings. And so she's tied up in competency proceedings for a number, at least a year, before they can even bring her to stand trial. So, you know, she's really pretty delusional when she's talking to her lawyers, but, you know, you always wonder, is it crazy like a fox again, or is she really delusional? So they had to kind of sift through that before they could actually bring her to trial.
And what about Ron's Young's deteriorating health? What's the state of that by this time?
By this time, he has he's gotten the procedure that he needs. He's clearly in recovery mode. he goes to trial. And he's convicted, of course, and he's winding up in the appellate process. But he gets the judge sentences him to double consecutive life sentences, which is actually an illegal sentence. And so on appeal, it's corrected, and it's still a life sentence, but it can't, you know, the judge was just so incensed at the end of the trial that he was trying to give him, you know, the maximum that you could possibly get, because it was such a heinous crime and it left such a human debris in the making.
Now, her trial, when does it begin, and what is the media response? We haven't talked about the media response to this story except in the introduction that this is a big story. So tell us what the media response is at the beginning of her trial, Tell us how it's framed.
Are you talking about her story is profiled. It's just splattered all over the press. Everyone's followed the story, particularly in Tucson. And so the first ploy by defense lawyers is moving the venue because there's no way she's going to get a fair trial with, you know, all of the media attention that's been put on her case. She's already been profiled, not only in my book, but in a number of television shows. She's on Dateline. So her whole story is out there before she even goes to trial. So that's a problem for the defense team as they try to build their case and make sure that she gets a fair trial. The courtroom itself is a circus. When I attended even Ron Young's trial, it was a circus. It was a very interesting scenario for me because I'm also a defense lawyer, and I practice up in Maricopa County, and it's very different. I don't know if this is a typical thing or if this is just for their trial, but the whole courtroom was cordoned off with sections. So the victim's family attended almost every day of trial at Ron's trial, and I have no doubt that they did that at Pam's trial as well, but almost the entire courtroom was reserved for them. It was a very large family. And then there was a piece of it reserved for the press and for cameras and journalists. And then there was a very, very small, almost standing room only for any public person that wanted to come in. So it was an unusual setting in that regard. It almost reminded me a little bit of the Jodi Arias trial up in Phoenix that happened recently. But
right.
So I think for Pam to get any type of, you know, I think that was the concern of the defense is, are we going to get a fair trial for Pam? Because it's just so, everybody already has an opinion formed on this. You know, imagine trying to pick a jury for that. So,
sure.
And then they had to come up with a different defense, obviously, than Ron's.
You talk about some of the witnesses and what they contributed to this, and you talk about Heather. Tell us just some of the highlights of some of the testimony that really put the nail in the coffin for her, Pamela.
Well, I mean, she had people coming out of the woodwork. She had a witness who did not appear in Ron's trial, and I cannot recall her name now. She was a woman that worked with Pam, who was a friend of hers, and she came out of the woodwork for Pam's trial, and they brought her in almost as a surprise witness at the end. And she took the stand and said, you know, this was something that she believed Pam had orchestrated this because it was a conversation that they had had years earlier. And so she became sort of the smoking gun for the prosecution, where she just came out there and said, yeah, you know, Pam and I had this conversation. And so I think that was a surprise to Pam, certainly, because they could find her. There were also a number of nannies that testified that I think sealed Pam's coffin and Ron's coffin, but more so Pam's, obviously, where one in particular, Kevin McDonald, testified that Pam was absolutely living the life of a socialite, was, you know, had probably more than just a business relationship with Ron, that Ron was against type. It didn't make sense that she was with Ron because she normally went for the very attractive, swanky, rich, wealthy men, and Ron was not that. So that also cast suspicion on that. So it was interesting. And then they brought in, you know, the defense for Pam was that it was Neil McNeese that, you know, was actually the killer. So they cast light on that and Gary's dealings with Neil McNeese. So it was a different case. Pam's case was different than Ron's, but certainly more involved.
And what was her demeanor during this trial?
She The only way really to describe her, you have to kind of have a before and after portrait of her. I mean, she was obviously known in the Aspen circles as a socialite, which meant she was always, you know, very classily dressed, a beautiful woman. She was highlighted, actually her home was highlighted in one of the papers up in Aspen. So you take that and you contrast it with her look in the courtroom. So she was kind of dumpy looking, obviously no makeup. She looked very much like a frenetic bird. Not really seeming to understand what was going on in the courtroom. Whether that was an act or not, it remains to be seen. The interesting thing about Pam, there was one story where someone had described her. It was very early on in her divorce to Gary, where, you know, you take this woman that's dressed to the nines, very well put together, would never be seen without, you know, makeup and dolled up, but she arrives at the courthouse dressed very frumpy, very dowdy, her hair in a bun, sensible shoes, sort of a dress that made her look like a bag. This was her demeanor in court. So it was almost like she was chameleon-like. She would dress the part. And so, or other people would like to surmise that that was actually her true character. It was sort of a, like the old story of the witch, you know, the witch who's coming out of her magic spell, and this is what she looks like really. So that was always the thought I had when I saw her in the courtroom, that this was actually the real Pam, this sort of crazed, sociopathic figure, not the glamorized woman that she played, not the part that she played. So the real Pam was sitting in the courtroom.
What about Pamela's family at trial? What was their reaction to all of this? The hearing of everything,
I didn't have a whole lot of contact with Pam's family. But one common denominator about that is they were not surprised. There was enough in Pam's past to have made what occurred consistent in her life. So I don't think that there was this sort of indignant shock and awe feeling. I think it was almost like, you know, we're not surprised.
What was the result? What was the end result, and what was the media response?
The end result to Pam's is she's sentenced to natural life without the possibility of parole. And so she was convicted of murder and conspiracy to commit murder. And the media, I think, has responded probably the way that I would expect them to respond, which is, you know, she got what she deserved. This was a sensational case. This was an investigation that destroyed so many people's lives, and I think I would say including the detectives. You know, this was a career building case and a career ending case. He retired after this, and I think it left, you know, the family destroyed. Nobody came out a winner in this, and so I think it was one of those cases that, you know, people come back to again and again, and certainly this program has, is because it's really an interesting insight into what happens to people when, you know, it's almost like be careful what you wish for, you know. You know, the two of them murdered for money and wound up paupers. And they wound up in a prison of their own making. And so, you know, was it worth it? No. You know, it led to this path of destruction that, you know, now they both kind of got what they deserved.
And it didn't, but it didn't help the reputation very much, so the victim sometimes is rehabilitated in death, or at least spared or some sympathy allotted him. Mm-hmm. But this wasn't good for the victim's reputation whatsoever, this entire thing, was it?
No, and that's really the interesting part of this case. I think in a lot of, in really probably most murder cases, you have a sympathetic victim. And you have this sort of sense of, you know, when the killer's caught and sentenced and the case is over, you have this sense of almost like, okay, now I can move on with my life. Now I've got some kind of closure, some kind of peace. In this case, it's very unsettling because you have a victim who, you know, he may have been larger than life and very dynamic and very magnetic personality, but hard to say whether he was sympathetic or well-liked. He was, you know, embroiled in a lot of stuff, a lot of illegal activity, and he did some not very nice things. And I think that all of that got highlighted in this very public arena. And so, yeah, that is one of the strange things about this case and why I actually chose to write it from the point of view of the two sociopaths, because there wasn't, it's not a typical case where you have the profile of the victim and you bring out that sort of sympathy and emotional reaction in the reader or the audience or the people watching this case. So you have to decide how you're going to approach it. And so, yeah, in the end of the day, it almost leaves you sort of hollow.
And you do talk about, again, it's not a happy ending for Detective James Gamber in any way. There's no celebration on his part. It is, as you describe in the book, I'm not describing your actual words, but you say something that this is not just an obsession, or this is not just a job. This is a sickness that he has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it becomes this sort of, you know, at the end of the day, he's invested so much time and energy and so much of himself in, you know, just solving this and getting some closure. And I think what's very striking about it and what maybe many homicide detectives could relate to is you really never get closure. There isn't any such thing in a lot of this because the human toll on everybody who participates in an investigation like this is just, you know, it's really indescribable. And so I think that, you know, Gamber has to find a way to come to terms with that. I mean, he wasn't even recognized in his own department, you know, and I mean, he didn't even get the accolades or the credit that he deserved. I think I describe in the book, there's an award ceremony that's given and he doesn't even want to attend, you know, there's nothing rewarding about it. It just sort of took a toll on everybody.
We didn't mention, but you had, this was an incredible task for you too, with the warehouse, as you mentioned, of evidence, graphic crime scene photos, hundreds of hours of interviews with potential suspects, thousands of pages of police reports, volumes of financial records, bomb debris. You had 11,000 emails that you have to look at or consider. This was a big investigation on your part as well, wasn't this?
Yes, this was a really an astronomical undertaking because if you can imagine, I was a full-time lawyer during this writing of this book. I was a capital lawyer, so I was doing death penalty work. I had to be careful because I didn't want to expose things. I mean, I was almost like a legal landmine as I was going through this. So I was working that, mindful of what I felt like I could disclose and not disclose in the writing of the book because I didn't want to unravel a 10-year investigation by, you know, exposing something that may not be admissible in court. I was fortunate enough to be given access to this treasure trove of information. I mean, from a writer/journalist perspective, it was incredible to be able to sit there and listen to recordings and come up with a profile and formulate a way to sift through this information to make it a story that was compelling enough for people to want to read it. I mean, it was truly remarkable. And I should mention, I lived in Phoenix at the time, so I was driving to Tucson three times a week, spending 6 or 7 hours at a time in the police department, going through that evidence and going to the appellate court and going through that evidence. You know, it was just an astronomical undertaking at the time. But the case was absolutely fascinating, and it really played to a lot of my strengths because, you know, as a capital lawyer, I was doing a lot of that kind of work, going behind the scenes, investigating, you know, so it was playing to my strengths that way. And I just found the case so compelling from so many different angles, not only from the perspective of the two sociopaths, but also from, you know, the perspective of being able to bring the experience of Detective Gamber to light, because I don't think that that's delved into very much in books, sure. You know, just what he was going through. So it was a very interesting experience.
Yes, I want to applaud you for the incredible effort you put into, I guess, demonstrating and illustrating this, especially the life of and the course of this, how it affected this detective especially, but of all the players involved. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about A Socialite Scorned, the murder of a Tucson high roller. Kelly, for those people that might want to check out other work, or is there a Facebook page, tell us how they might contact you or look at other work that you have done.
Sure, and thank you very much for having me on the show. You can find me at my website. It's kerriedroban.com. It's KerriedroBan. And then from there, I have multiple links to Amazon. You can find all of my other books on there, and Facebook and all the rest of that, and social media. So I'm out there. And I should mention, too, there's going to be a production of Socialite Scorned. I'm not sure when it's going to air, but sometime in March, I believe, put out by Jupiter Productions.
Great. Well, that sounds great. We'll have to look forward to that. Thank you very much. Again, I want to thank you, Kelly Droban, for A Socialite Scorned. Incredible story. Thank you very much. Murder of a Tucson High Roller. Thank you. Have a great night. Thank you, Kelly. Good night.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.